House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Laws in session. And to accommodate Representative Sumner, we will start off with a public hearing on House Bill 3470. Representative? Counsel, you want to explain the bill, please?
House Bill 3470 comes to you from Representative Sumner at the request of the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. It allows healthcare provider and healthcare recipient to enter into a dispute resolution agreement under which the healthcare recipient would waive any rights to bring a civil action and have a jury trial in return for a dispute resolution process. Prohibits a healthcare provider from requiring a healthcare recipient to sign a dispute resolution agreement in return for healthcare services. And under the agreement, the healthcare provider would be allowed to give a discount to the healthcare recipient. Mr. Chairman, the committee, this bill does have an appropriation to the Workers' Comp Board, and it has a blank in it. It probably means at some point this bill would have to go to Budget Committee.
Okay, thank you.
A discussion with LFO on that issue.
All right, I appreciate the comments. Representative?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Members of the panel, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Max Sumner. I represent House District 18. That's Silverton, Mount Angel, Aurora. When I came to work here as a freshman, I was cautioned about don't put your name on something unless you understand what it's about. Taking that to heart, I took the bill home and researched it. I read it thoroughly. I understand it. And I'm introducing the bill for Mr. Kevin Mannix. I think this bill has great merit. It has a capability or at least the possibility of lowering medical costs as well as speeding up the litigation process. And you'll be hearing from Mr. Mannix a little later, and he'll tell you exactly what this bill does. I believe this is a good bill. It has a lot of potential, and I thank you very much for your attention. Any questions at all, sir?
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I just have an overriding question, Representative. I know you're not an attorney and don't practice workers' comp law, and it appears that this is an overcomp overlay to the medical malpractice problem. But my overriding question is, I didn't see a funding mechanism. In other words, persons that sign up for medical services for medical health providers have to agree to this dispute resolution process, which can lead to forms of compensation. I don't see how the compensation is paid for or how the administrative costs are paid for. Do you anticipate that the medical providers would be assessed premiums like an insurance policy, or do you think they should come out of the general fund?
Mr. Ackerman, board members, I agree that insurance companies should not be further burdened with litigation processes and paying medical claims. However, I don't believe that the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project has even entered into the field of figuring out how to finance it. I believe that's some work that needs to be done further. I can't give you a good answer at this time, Mr. Ackerman.
Okay, well, we read the bill the same way then.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your participation. Mr. Mannix?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project, but in particular, I'm here on behalf of people of the state of Oregon, in a sense that this is the kind of dynamic thinking that we think needs to be applied across the board to some of the issues that confront us. If we were here in 1905 talking about workers and industrial injuries, we'd be talking about the challenge that they face in trying to receive compensation for those industrial injuries. Because in 1905, in Oregon, you would have to file a civil action and go through the courts in order to get a remedy. You would also have to prove negligence on the part of your employer in order to make a recovery. And the people of Oregon and their legislature over a number of years developed a workers' compensation system. It had its gestation in about 1911, built from there on, to set up a system that allowed for a swift and fair process to provide a remedy for injured workers where they would not routinely have to get an attorney, where they would not have to go to court. They could simply present their industrial injury claim, and that claim could be processed and benefits would be provided. It is today a working, positive system, and the way it's paid for is employers pay for it through premiums that they pay or through their own self-insured costs. This process evolved. It's not perfect, but it is much better than the process that existed 100 years ago. Today we're confronted with what is sometimes referred to as a medical malpractice crisis, but I would actually refer to it as a crisis in terms of the provision of care to those who receive medical injuries. Setting aside the issue of fault, we have a large number of folks who at various times suffer seemingly small injuries in the medical process for which there is no recovery. There's no recovery because the amount of recovery does not justify hiring a lawyer and going to court. If there's a mistake in surgery and it's acknowledged to be a mistake and it adds another week to the time that you had to be off work before you could get back to work, you've been harmed, but there's probably not much value to the recovery so as to justify getting a lawyer. This bill is designed to reorient the thinking of the system to say, why don't we have a comprehensive scheme that focuses on providing benefits for the widest range of folks who've been injured in the process of medical treatment? It also acknowledges that we've had a dynamic expansion in the scope of medical science and that our understanding of what goes on in the treatment process is much better today than even 20 or 10 years ago. The bill is not perfect because it is an innovative piece and it does require additional work. For example, the funding mechanism is not fully addressed in this bill and it needs to be fully addressed before we can implement something. The funding mechanism that's anticipated in this bill is frankly that the medical providers would have to pay for the recovery process and the claims process, the payment process. That can be done either through them gaining insurance and then having insurance premiums or an assessment system among themselves. There are a variety of mechanisms that need to be explored. But what you do have in front of you is a solid beginning piece for intellectual discussion about whether we want to provide a new option for Oregonians in terms of dealing with the issue of accidents that may occur during the process of the provision of medical treatment. I commend this bill to you for consideration. I've provided some talking points to staff. I would also point out that on December 15, 2004, the governor, the Senate president, and Speaker of the House received a report of the Professional Panel for the Analysis of Medical Professional Liability Insurance. And one of the things that they point out in their report is that the current civil litigation system is not really effective in delivering benefits to those who are harmed in comparison with auto insurance, in comparison with the workers' compensation system. Use of the civil litigation system for medical malpractice provides only about 38% of the premiums going to the claimants ultimately, whereas in the workers' compensation and auto insurance systems, a much larger proportion does get to the claimants themselves. Over 44% of the medical malpractice system right now goes to legal costs, and that's divided approximately equally between plaintiffs and defense. That whole report, I think, contains in it documentation that tells us we need to move in a new direction. And as a final set of remarks, Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, I would indicate to you that we are not alone in exploring these options. I'd like to think that we're always unique and we're always ahead. Sometimes we pick up on ideas from elsewhere. 2 years ago, we were looking at Florida and Virginia and what they were doing in the OBGYN area, and we tried to expand on that. We had legislation that did that. We've now evolved moving more towards a voluntary workers' compensation model, which is in front of you today, but I find on doing a research not in legal periodicals but in more commercial periodicals that there are states that are exploring this option, Massachusetts being one of them. They haven't gone very far yet either, but they are at the point of saying, wow, what about this idea? I suggest to you today that while this piece of legislation needs additional work, if the bill itself does not end up being moved, or if it's going to be moved to that deep dark hole known as the Ways and Means, or excuse me, the House Appropriations Committee, then what we ought to consider is whether or not there should be an interim task force, which is given the challenge of further refining this proposal to bring something back to the 2007 session, which is viable, which has a funding mechanism, and where there's been additional community input. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Maddox. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Unless council had a question. Okay. Mr. Mannix, thank you for presenting this idea. I wanted to focus in on the mechanism by which the recipient of services agrees to the alternative dispute resolution and the provision of the bill that says that there could be couldn't be a requirement of an agreement in order to receive service, but that there could be a discount. How do you expect this is going to work in real life in terms of what the experience is of a patient who comes in, is at the front desk of a medical group and is signing in? Are they going to get a boilerplate agreement? Is it going to describe a one-fee schedule, and it's going to describe a discount that's available to them? How is that going to work in real life?
Representative McPherson, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, actually a very good question, and the answer is that it will depend on how this evolves, but our own thinking is actually the discount won't be at the door of the clinic or at the desk of the clinic, but it will be with health insurers who may agree to provide health insurance packages where they have designated providers where they say, we have agreements with these providers, and if you sign up for this health insurance plan, it's going to cost you X minus 20% because we've got this alternative dispute resolution mechanism built into this plan. But if you don't want that alternative dispute resolution, and then you've got the X plan, which doesn't have the discount. We are looking to this being an evolving process where those who put together the insurance package will be looking to negotiate the improved rates. I'm not talking about the insurance practice in terms of the recovery claims. I'm talking about health insurance. Health insurance providers being able to negotiate better rate packages based on this, and we would be specifically authorizing discounts in the process.
Okay. Follow up if I could, Mr. Wright. So it will be the point of decision is then the employer's decision when they're contracting with a preferred provider network. Rather than the individual employee decision. And I guess my question from that is, do you think that decision for the employer to agree to, in effect, contract away certain remedies that would otherwise be available to the patient would be binding on the patient?
Representative McPherson, Mr. Chairman, and members of the subcommittee, no. In fact, while we envision this being done, one method being done through the health insurance process, the employer would have to allow the worker to make the choice. I can envision a system where when you look at the alternative plans that are available for you to sign up, which most larger employers provide alternatives and they say, here's how much we'll pay. They say, well, we'll provide this much. Now, you can have plan A, which is the regular deal when it comes to civil litigation if you have any medical injury. Plan B, by the way, will cost you 20% less, but you're agreeing to this alternative dispute resolution mechanism and you're waiving your right. That's one methodology. Another is, quite frankly, individuals do buy health insurance. You can have individuals signing up saying, I prefer to go in this direction. The bill also allows for a clinic to say, yes, when you come in and you're signing up for the first time as a patient, not in the middle of your care, we've got a discount available if you choose to go into our alternative dispute process. And you could still do that, which is the first point you brought up, Representative McPherson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Yes, Council.
Mr. Members of the Committee, Mr. Mannix, last session the legislature created the professional panel for the analysis of medical professional liability insurance. Is that the kind of work group that you would be looking for? If I remember correctly, we started off with a bill on this subject, and it mutated. It was amended into a creation of this task force.
Mr. Chairman, Council, yes. But I think the mandate to the panel ought to be very specific. Look at this plan, see if you can evolve this plan. Don't study the entire landscape and look for how many options are out there for other ideas, but take this idea, run with it, see what you can build it up into, and bring it back to the legislature. So the short answer is yes, with focus.
Thank you.
I have a few questions, unless there's others from the committee. Mr. Mannix, in your historical discourse this morning, you suggested that the workers' compensation system evolved into a no-fault system. Do you view House Bill 3470 as a no-fault device also?
Mr. Chairman, actually right now it is not a no-fault device because there is a causation standard that's put into this. That's all, one of the topics of discussion that needs to be in the forefront too, because no-fault, of course, is an obvious then trade-off. You simply have to show, in effect, proximate cause but no negligence. This bill requires some showing, as I recall in the standard language here, that there is, in effect, some level of, I'll say, negligence. Some states have explored the idea of looking towards adverse consequences which are not anticipated in the course of medical care. Why? Because a lot of medical providers don't want to ever acknowledge they did anything wrong, but they might acknowledge that, well, yes, we had an adverse consequence that wasn't anticipated. So you may end up with some artful language that lets you say something went wrong here without talking about who's the cause of what went wrong. This is an area that needs to be carefully discussed because we are talking about a trade-off here. Certainly, when you have a situation where someone has been negligent, right now you have a recovery mechanism. If you're going to go into a recovery mechanism that has more limited benefits and trade-offs, one of the trade-offs is, yes, you get a speedier process, a simpler process. You don't need an attorney. You may get an accepted claim. But part of that is, well, also, what is the standard of fault that has to be applied here? We certainly want to make sure that this bill applies only to unanticipated consequences or consequences that are outside the usual range. If you have a surgery where it's expected you're off work for 2 weeks and you're off work for 2 weeks, that's life. On the other hand, if something goes wrong in the surgery and there's a complication that keeps you off work for 2 months, the complication may have been a 5% anticipated risk of the surgery. Do you say someone's at fault when that happened, or do you say that's a consequence that's not fully anticipated? I think we still need to have discussion about the standard of fault or no fault that goes into this legislation.
Let me ask a couple more questions. I note that under the bill, the Board of Medical Examiners was set up to schedule of injuries for compensation purposes. Don't you feel there's an actual conflict of interest between by allowing the Board of Medical Examiners to schedule a series of injuries or schedule compensation, which would be perhaps assessed back to its members?
Mr. Chairman, no more of a conflict than having the Board of the State Bar of Disciplined Lawyers with final authorization from the Supreme Court. We do have a designated group which is in charge, which is supposed to be knowledgeable, and they should be able to figure out how things work. So I say that respectfully, but I do note that the entire disciplinary process for lawyers is run by lawyers. And I don't have a problem with medical practitioners establishing a system which tries to evaluate what medical injuries have occurred and what damages have occurred. However, if there's a better mechanism, we should be open to finding a better mechanism. And perhaps there ought to be an independent body established to do this.
But my question was, regardless of whether the lawyers are doing the same thing or not, or whether two rights make a wrong, is there a conflict of interest here?
I would say, Mr. Chairman, I would say not, in the sense that we are talking about policymaking across the board that involves anybody who's in receiving medical care, and we all the time require boards and commissions to develop standards that apply to their area of expertise, and we don't consider it a conflict unless they individually have something invested in the process as opposed to professionally.
Let me ask another question about the application process. For, as I read the bill, the medical provider can decline to provide medical services unless the applicant signs up for compensation under this proposal. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman,
if so, doesn't that violate some sense of medical ethics, where the physician or medical care provider says, unless you sign this agreement, I'm going to withhold services?
Mr. Chairman, I think that we will have to be very careful in terms of the language and the process for declining to provide services. But if you're talking about the beginning of a professional relationship in a non-emergency situation, it should not be an ethical issue. We allow medical professionals these days to decline for to participate in certain medical procedures on the basis of their own conscience. We certainly allow anybody, as a matter of contractual law, to decline to enter into a contractual relationship. This anticipates that at the beginning of a contractual relationship, not after the relationship has begun, one gets to set forth the standards by which they are willing to proceed. It cannot include emergency situations, and it cannot apply when you are in the midst of care, because then that's really an adhesion situation where you're being forced, the other person is being forced into a decision where the relationship is already existing and they're getting care.
In part of the claims process, I did not find any provision for discovery. Has that been omitted from the bill?
Mr. Chairman, there is no provision for discovery at the initiation of a claim. In the workers' compensation system, an injured worker simply files a claim, and in about 87% of the instances, maybe 85% of the instances, the claim is accepted and benefits are provided and no issues arise, so no discovery occurs. If the claim is denied, and one wishes to challenge the denial, one requests a hearing. And in the hearings process, there is very dramatic and effective discovery provided. There's 100% discovery provided by both sides. And I would anticipate that's the process that would be followed here.
Of course, in that situation, the discovery process is bolstered by statutory mandates. Isn't that correct in the workers' comp
field? I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
In the workers' comp field, the discovery is bolstered by statutory mandates to provide discovery. I didn't find the same here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. And if it's thought necessary to put those statutory mandates in, we'd certainly be happy to cooperate with that.
I notice also that in the workers' compensation field, and using that as a model, if you have a case which has a claim which has been denied at the outset by the carrier, and that is reversed by a hearings officer or administrative law judge, the worker would also be able to recover his or her attorney's fees. I don't see that they have that flexibility in House Bill 3470. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, you are correct that the legislation does not provide for that, but I agree it should be amended to specifically provide for that, because that was anticipated in the model as it was being developed.
Likewise, under the workers' compensation model, as I recall it, transcription costs when an appeal is being prepared is borne administratively by administrative costs of the system, and here it's a cost that's assessed back to the appellant. Would you not think the better practice would be to provide that transcription costs be a part of the administrative expenses of the program?
Mr. Chairman, I would agree that were we proceeding with this bill, that we would want to take as many pieces of the workers' compensation system. In fact, we should take the entire workers' compensation ship and use it as a model, and then make choices about equipment you might want to remove from the ship as opposed to rebuild the ship. Oregon has got an extraordinarily good workers' compensation system. Not perfect, but extraordinarily good. And I think that the model there is a great model for us to use, and any elements of that model that would expedite this kind of claims process ought to be used.
Thank you. Just a couple more questions. Under the workers' compensation model, it's a no-fault system. The worker does not have to establish that his employer was at fault. And as a result of that, there's a trade-off in that there's no compensation for non-economic damages as pain and suffering. But this model, you still require fault. Does that mean that you would have a component for pain and suffering?
Mr. Chairman, good question. And the shorter answer is no, but the longer answer is when you craft a bill of this type, you expect to go through a negotiation process about how much fault we're going to cover in exchange for how much limitation on damages. And as you work your way through that process, you discern where the balance is. And this is simply an opening part of the discussion as to where the balance might be, taking a cautionary approach in terms of liability at the beginning, but being very open to modifying that in exchange for being able to better determine what the damages might be that are allowed under the system.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mannix, in clarification of a question that the Chair had made in regard to a medical care provider who might decline to provide services, I see that is in on the page 2, subsection 4 of section 2, that if the agreement is rescinded under parent 2 above for three certain conditions, I note number 5, it says execution of the agreement is voluntary and that a health care provider may not condition the provision of services on execution of the agreement. Is that correct? And for clarification, please.
Representative Flores, Mr. Chairman, right now this bill emphasizes the right of contract and the capability of someone to back away from delivery of services under certain circumstances, but says that you can't start this contract in the middle of the services. You have to start it at the very beginning. But if someone else wants to back out in the middle of it, we've tried to limit those options. There's a sensitivity here. My view is that it ought to be made very clear at the beginning of the process that you're into this contractual process, that you've agreed to this alternative dispute resolution. Once you're into that, you don't get out of it for the entirety of the treatment program. Otherwise, someone can decide, well, you know, I wasn't happy today about this, so I'm withdrawing. You don't let people in contracts do that normally. And the intention here is that you shouldn't be allowed to do that on one side or the other. In other words, there ought to be equity from the beginning to the end. If you're into this contract, you stay with the contract. If you're out of the contract, you're both out of the contract and it's over. But neither one side or the other should be able to back out midstream.
Follow up.
You may.
So a medical care provider may not decline to provide services based upon the agreement, not having an agreement entered into. Is that correct?
Representative Flores, Mr. Chairman, if you'll tell me exactly which section you're talking about, I'll give you a precise answer.
Under Section 2, subparagraphs 4 and 5. Actually, I'm focusing on number 5.
Yes. All right. I can answer that one, Representative Flores, Mr. Chairman. That specifically says if the patient's basically saying, I'm backing out of this, I'm no longer agreeing, then the doctor says, well, then I'm backing out of care. And, yes, your understanding is correct.
Thank you. Further questions then from the committee counsel?
Chair, members of the committee, I will get copies of the report to you. But I was staff for half of the work group's meetings last year on the professional panel for an analysis of medical professional liability insurance. And it was a very interesting model in the sense that the first time I've ever seen a work group where an outside actuary was hired. It was hired through SAFE. There was funds put forward by SAFE. And this actuary came in and did a very detailed report. I've got a three-page summary, which I can get you copies of. I also have the report. I think we have it in electronic version and can send it to your office, but it's a couple hundred pages long. But they did a lot of the groundwork in what is a very complicated area. And one of the things when you're going through this is that you have to realize that anything we do has to, especially if we get into a workers' comp model, one of the things they looked at was the laws in Florida and Virginia as it relates to what they call bad babies. It's a no-fault system that you have to be actuarially sound. There's a model I never saw done in the legislature before, and for a complex area like this, it seemed to work very well. It was a decent report. It was well put together. It was well-founded. And it not only compared Oregon, but it compared Oregon to Idaho and California and Washington and the rest of the country.
Thank you, counsel. Any further comments, Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Maddox, I think maybe what Representative Flores was troubled by is what strikes me as an inconsistency on page 2 and lines 25 through 29. That is, at the commencement of service, the service provider can't condition care on agreeing to waive these remedies, but upon rescission, they can back out completely. And it would seem inconsistent if the structure is going to be that you just charge more but you have an obligation to give service, whether it's from the outset or it's arising upon rescission. It would seem those could be maybe aligned more effectively. That's just a comment. I wanted to go back, though, to what I was focusing on before, which is just the mechanics of when a patient makes this decision. This is a pretty significant decision if certain things happen that may not be given much attention at the time because it's just part of the boilerplate of forms that are being pushed at someone. And it does seem to me that it really can't occur as a choice at the time of enrollment under various options provided by the employer because it has to be a contract between the patient and the provider. And so it really has to be at that commencement of service. That is, the patient comes into the clinic or the hospital desk and is filling out the forms for commencing the care relationship. At that time, it would seem to me have to be a separate document that contracts away one's right to sue in court. And that and that with these with an effect, I guess, an understanding that perhaps the employer's plan doesn't provide for the extra remedies. The employer may have already agreed in advance only to pay for the least cost option with respect to this point. And then the patient then would have a fee schedule that is an increment to be paid to have full remedies. Does that make sense as a way of trying to implement this?
Representative McPherson, Mr. Chairman, I think that the evolution of the ideas you're discussing does make sense. And we need to have that discussion about how we package this, how we put this together. I'm a great believer that the beauty of this legislative process is that you present an idea, you present as fully created an idea as you may, and then you open up the discussion and you get feedback and you engage in discussion about these. One of the things that could evolve out of this bill is something that we tried to do years ago, which failed, which is 24-hour coverage for employers. And it failed for a number of reasons. That is where they said to their workers, we're going to provide you with comprehensive health insurance and workers' compensation coverage, and it will be a seamless web of medical care. There are a variety of things that went wrong with that, mainly because there's so many different issues in workers' compensation, time loss, permanent disability, whereas with health care in those days, that wasn't an issue. I'm not suggesting we go in that direction, but I am suggesting that we do look to the employment sector, the health insurance sector, as parts of this process where we may be able to package a comprehensive plan where someone signs up for a different kind of health insurance, which is less expensive. But all of their contracts with all of their providers say we're into the alternative dispute resolution mechanism, and that's why we give you the discount. This bill doesn't have all of that written into it, and I do think we need to have that evolving discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, Counselor Bill Taylor was kind enough to hand me his copies of the summary of the report, and I know he indicated he'd get them to you. This is the December 15 report from the Professional Panel for the Analysis of Medical Professional Liability Insurance. If I may, I will pass these on up to the committee via staff so that you'll have them available immediately.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have three remaining witnesses on the sign-up sheet, Corey Streisinger, Maureen Bach, and Jane Myers. The three of you like to come forward, please. Good morning. You may proceed in any manner you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is Maureen Bach, who is the Chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. I just wanted to address a few issues briefly. My department, as you're probably aware, regulates insurance and workers' compensation, both of which are implicated to some degree by this concept. One of the written materials which I've made available, in addition to my written testimony, is a fact sheet on medical malpractice insurance and what the state of the market looks like today, because a lot of the discussions in this area are driven by concerns about medical malpractice insurance rates. We have been experiencing what's called a hard market of high premiums and limited availability, although that is softening somewhat. So that fact sheet's available to you. I heard Mr. Mannix's comments about this being a sort of work in progress and a discussion item rather than a finished piece. And there was some exchange between Mr. Mannix and Representative McPherson about possible implications for health insurance and employer-provided health insurance. And although that's not in the bill right now, obviously that's an area we would be interested in taking a very close look at, because one of the the areas we are responsible for is ensuring that the provision of health insurance is on fair and appropriate terms. But what I really wanted to focus on for the moment is the implications for the workers' compensation system. And again, recognizing that this appears to be a work in progress, the bill as drafted nevertheless does tie to the current workers' compensation system in a couple of ways. And I agree with Mr. Mannix that our current workers' compensation system is a success in terms of delivering low rates to employers and good benefits to injured workers. And I would certainly want to ensure that any system that appears to be engrafted onto it doesn't in fact cause unintended consequences or potential harm for the workers' compensation system. This bill involves the workers' compensation system, as I said, in two ways. One of them is it piggybacks on the compensation schedule for injured workers, and the other is that it has the workers' comp board involved in dispute resolution. Both of those do raise concerns for me. And I would say, as a preliminary matter, in response to some of the questions from the chair and other members to Mr. Mannix, the workers' compensation system is a fairly complex and highly regulated system that has many different procedural protections built in to ensure that injured workers do, in fact, receive what they are entitled to receive and that the system works smoothly. So to replicate something like the workers' compensation system would be a fairly complex task, certainly more than the bare bones in the bill. With respect to the compensation schedule, the bill directs the Board of Medical Examination of Examiners to create a compensation schedule for injured patients, but also directs that it be based to the greatest extent possible on the compensation schedule established under Chapter 656, which is workers' compensation. And that raises at least three areas of concern. One of them is, and I think this was noted, the compensation schedule for workers' compensation is based on a sort of system bargain where workers give up their right to jury trials and to the type of compensation that they would receive in a jury trial in exchange for a no-fault system. They receive compensation without regard to fault for job-related injuries. And what this bill would do is one half of that bargain, but not the other half. It would tie compensation to that workers' comp schedule, but under a fault-based system, so that the match does not seem to be appropriate. Secondly, the workers' compensation schedule is aimed at injured workers and returning workers to work. And a lot of that schedule is, in fact, based on employment. It is based on whether the worker is released to return to regular work, whether the worker has the ability to engage in gainful employment. It's very hard to see how those standards would apply to a birth-damaged baby or a 5-year-old or a senior citizen or someone who is disabled and unable to work. So using those incentives often are based on ensuring that that worker can return to work, because that is one of the goals of the workers' compensation system. So again, it does not seem like a very good match. And then finally, this is a matter that I think is certainly of great interest to my department and I think to everybody who has a stake in the workers' compensation system. One of the reasons I think our system is a success is that changes tend to be consensus-based. We have management and labor working hard together to ensure that the system continues to work and that changes work for everybody. And I am concerned that if a different and unrelated system relating to medical malpractice got sort of piggybacked onto the workers' compensation system, we'd have a whole bunch of stakeholders with different stakes trying to influence the workers' compensation system for other goals, and that would not be a good thing for the workers' compensation system. The final area I want to address is the implications for the workers' compensation board, because under this bill, the board and its administrative law judges would be responsible for resolving disputes whenever a claim is denied. That would be a fairly radical change in direction for the board, which currently its expertise and its focus is efficient, prompt resolution of workers' compensation disputes. Again, that's something that's very important to the workers' compensation system. This would involve the board in a whole new subject matter area, in adjudications about fault, which again are not part of the workers' comp system. We would certainly not want to see the focus of the board changed or the system bogged down by another system being engrafted upon it. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Ms. Bach would as well.
Fine. We'll take the questions when the panel has testified. So whomever wishes to go next.
Ms. Bach is simply here to answer questions rather than to have a testimony.
Okay, so these are Are you folks going to testify or just here to help us with the question and answer?
Mr. Chair, my name is Maureen Bach. I am the chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. I am simply here as a subject matter expert on the Workers' Compensation Board system and the fiscal that will be provided. So I will answer questions in that area, but I do not have any testimony.
Thank you. Ann?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. We're neutral on the bill at the moment and wanted to testify to see if we could get some questions answered before the committee. And we're very interested in tort reform, and this comes in that category. One of the big questions that we had is about the cost and also the interaction with insurance, professional liability insurance policies, how this might work together. Do want to point out that the workers' comp system does not provide much dental care. It is frequently not a subject of how workers are injured. So there's not a lot of experience in the workers' comp system with that. I wanted to point that out to you. Our president looked at it very briefly, and she's a practicing dentist in Corvallis, and she said that part of what was a problem is we have to give the patient papers, and they have to sign them, and then we have to hold the paper forever. But we have to give them 3 days to decide if they want to promise to do the conflict resolution pathway after we told them what needs to be done. We can't refuse treatment if they decide they'd rather sue us if there's a problem. So I think some of that's already been brought up here today. I also wanted to point out that on page 3 in section 5, paragraph 5, that's a bit troubling, too, about the administrative law judge is not bound by common law, statutory rules of evidence, et cetera, and can conduct the hearing in a way that will achieve substantial justice. That's kind of a very broad kind of concept, and where you have an injured party, frequently you there's a sympathetic reaction just for the fact that the party's injured, and some evidence or substantial justice may tilt towards the injured party. And that's all I have to say.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony, and I'll ask the committee if you have any questions from the committee. Yes, counsel.
Chairman of the committee. Ms. Streisinger, I think you're familiar with the report that came out of the professional panel analysis of medical malpractice.
I think you are anyways. And it made three recommendations. We recommend the legislature continue to address the problems of high malpractice premiums by considering a system to manage most claims on a non-judicial basis with infrequent need for legal representation and other insurance systems. We also recommend the legislature consider the feasibility of a healthcare profession owned and operated self-insurance system. We recommend the insurance regulatory system have as one of its goals making malpractice insurance affordable. Do you think it would be beneficial for a further study in this area that is similar to what was done by this medical malpractice task force the last interim?
Mr. Chair, counsel, certainly any of those areas, I think, are fruitful areas for study. The Florida and Virginia systems have been mentioned. Those are the models that that are the closest analogy, although they do differ in some very significant respects. We have, the panel looked at those. We have looked at them. They are limited to very specific issues, I believe, having to do with neurological damage to newborns. And what those systems, because they are no fault, what they found is they tend to be extremely expensive. That is, more cases get compensated, which may be a good thing from a public policy standpoint, but it is also quite expensive. And so what we have heard about both of those systems is that having an extremely narrow focus is the only way that they are manageable. But are they areas that could benefit from further study? Certainly they could.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Seeing none then, we appreciate your testimony this morning, and thank you for participating with us. Are there any further witnesses on House Bill 3470? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3470. And I will open a
public hearing on House Bill 2295. Council, tell us about this bill.
Chair, I commend members of the committee. House Bill 2295 creates a state court facility task force. It directs the task force to study issues relating to state court facilities and to make recommendations on minimum standards for suitable and sufficient court facilities. It sunsets this task force on January 2, 2008. The original bill provides a funding from the unitary assessment for violations. You have before you -1 amendments. The -1 amendments change the funding source for the task force from the unitary assessment fees to the state lottery fund.
Thank you, Council. And I'm going to call persons up pretty much in the order that they signed the registration sheet. Chief Justice Carson, Kingsley Crick, Judge Cook, Doug Bray. We get four people up here at a time. That would help us.
Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning, and members of the committee and staff. I'm Wally Carson. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. But I'm here today in my role as Chief Administrative Head of the Judicial Department, and we're talking about court facilities. I have a few opening remarks. I usually get the history job. That's because of my age, I think. And so I'll give you a little background. Most of you are probably aware of the background. Then we'll hear from Kingsley Sick, the State Court Administrator, and then we'll hear from Dale Kosh, who's the presiding judge in Multnomah County, and Doug Gray, the Trial Court Administrator in Multnomah County, and Mari Miller will take my seat when I'm through, and she is the Trial Court Administrator from Clackamas County. They're the people that are actually living with the problems of court facilities. In 1981, from a bill introduced at the request of the Commission on the Judicial Branch that spanned a two-year study, the result was a state takeover, and that's jargon for the transfer of personnel and operations from counties in our 36 counties, now 27 judicial districts, to the state judicial department. They became our employees and the operations staff. Theretofore were county employees and county funds. And quite significantly, the state also took over the injury and defense fund requirement from the counties. The counties were left with providing the facilities for the court system in Oregon, state court system. And the magic language of suitable and sufficient, very soft words, were in the statute requiring counties to provide suitable and sufficient facilities for the courts. And I should say a good number of the counties have done a superb job, and some have not, and some of those who have not kept up with the needs of the courts tried but didn't have the money to do it. So this is not a blame game. We're trying to find answers, not more questions. We've had about a 20-year-plus struggle to resolve suitable and sufficient what the facilities are and to see if we can get suitable quarters for the people that use our court system. And in generally, we've been unsuccessful. And we have many courts in disrepair. For instance, four or five are over 100 years old, and I think the leader is Representative Worth, Benton County, 116 years old or plus and growing and aging. Seven are over 90 years of age. 15 are between 50 and 89 years of age. Six are between 39 and 49. One is over 20. And the only spring chicken we have is the one that represented Gerard's home in Klamath Falls. And it's Klamath County. It's a beautiful facility. The average age is 71 years for our courthouses. Now, before you think I'm saying old is bad, I'm not. The Oregon Supreme Court building is the only one that the Judicial Department owns. The rest of them are owned by county, in some cases state, but most of them are county-owned facilities. Our building is about 91 years of age, and I have an attachment to it because my grandfather, when he served in the Senate, introduced a bill to build a wing to the Capitol building for the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, that was changed to a freestanding building because on the 25th of April of 1935, the old Capitol building burned down, and that would have taken the Supreme Court building with it had they not changed it. Our building opened on our birthday, our state's birthday, February 14th of 1914. The only really new construction we've had by divine intervention, an earthquake in 93 in Klamath Falls and a fire a couple 3 months ago in Hermiston for what's called the West County Court Facility. Other than that, we have not done much in that area. We're indebted, the idea for the bill was primarily that of former Representative Max Williams, who over the last two interims, I believe, worked on preparing the bill in its original form, and now Kingsley Click will explain the Dash 1 amendments. I should say that we have another bill, or there is another bill that Representative McPherson authored and has been working with us on a new direction for funding courthouses that I'm very excited about. That's not before you. I just wanted to advise you what's out there and also to thank Representative McPherson for assisting us in this program. We just must get better court facilities, and you'll hear how unsafe and uneconomical they are. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be quiet and respond to questions now or later.
Let's take them all through the panel first.
I'll get right back.
Fine. Who wishes to go next?
For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator, and I'm going to frame the amendments in the bill and then turn it back over to the rest of the panel, and then I'll be available to answer any specific questions on the bill provisions. The Chief provided you with the background and the history. This bill was a creation of Representative Max Williams' task force when he chaired the Interim Judiciary Committee on this project. It also has had life in several other versions in preceding sessions. There's usually been support for the task force concept because the legislature created the current policy with the state court system and the county facilities, and I think because most of the resolution would come through in the way of legislation and other related financing items, that would be very appropriate to preserve that task force concept to set what the standards and the approaches and the priorities would be. I wanted to modify what committee counsel said. The funding source for the task force is really still in on the first page in subsection 6, which really provides for contributions of funds and assistance. And we have in the past had opportunities for grants to fund the work. There could be a direct appropriation for the task force, but for the most part in the past, we've secured opportunities for funding from grant sources. What then happens with this bill under our Dash 1 amendments is the task force is still the overview committee, but we provide the tools for implementing recommendations that might come out of this task force. And on the back page of my testimony, which is one pager, it does walk through these amendments. Really, the part one is the task force, and the part two are three what I call tools or opportunities to finance capital improvements when there are recommendations. And these type of improvements would require legislation in your 07 session, and they would go through the pre-07 session budgeting processes and bill drafting processes that you have. But briefly, what they do is Section 4 amends 461-540 of the ORS. That covers the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund, which does receive monies from lottery, but also from other sources. And it just adds to the definition of furthering economic development to clearly include that the services or financial assistance for construction and renovation of state court facilities could be one of the recognized uses. In most of these, I think the argument is there that they could already be covered, but we felt with the work group that the chief had that came up with some of these suggestions that to specify it would make it much easier when you went out for financing, if you could point to the statutory authority, which clearly set out the state tax, the state court facilities as an item, excuse me. Section 5 and 6 are amend 461-547, which covers the part of the Lottery Commission's distribution that goes already to counties for economic development activities. And all that does is just clearly allows the use for construction and renovation of state courthouse facilities as part of the recognized development activities. Section 7 amends 281-085. And that covers the definitions for certificates of participation that are issued by DAS for on behalf of the state. And it just includes in that definition of recognized financing agreements under subsection 4A, a category that pertains to the cost for construction or renovation of the state courthouse facilities. As noted, this is what we would call enabling legislation to allow both anything coming out of the task force to be included as part of 07-09 budget proposals and also for the Judicial Department to be able to work in 06 with the budget processes. Any actions to incur expenses to design a capital financing project would have to go through the legislative process through bills that you've seen probably similarly this session for various capital projects. And with the COPs, there are limitations on how much commitment can be made for debt service, and all those things have processes too. But it's very important to the Judicial Department to be able to, provide some tools to leverage the county's abilities to help deal with these public facilities. It's also important to us to be able to be creative with both public safety, private and private partnership opportunities that could come up and help us meet that obligation. As noted, a healthy economy and community really relies in many ways on having that courthouse with its services available to it, and this is one way to provide that access and to the citizens of the state. Judge Koch can provide you more information about what's happening directly in Multnomah County with this issue and how this bill might help their endeavors.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dale Koch, and I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County, in the Circuit Court in Multnomah County. And I'm here to put maybe a little bit of a face on what we're facing in the individual counties now with court facilities. You saw the map that was provided as part of the handout, I believe, that kind of lists the age of the courthouses in the various counties. And you'll see from that that we're not the oldest courthouse, but by far and away not the newest either. Our court facility was built there in Multnomah County in 1912, and the time that it was built, there were 17 courtrooms in that facility. It was built with a 50-year capacity. They did a 50-year plan, some good long-term planning, and now 91 years later, we are still in that same building, and instead of having 17 courtrooms, we now have 40 courtrooms in that building. We obtained those exterior courtrooms by, in some cases, actually taking floors in the building and cutting the floors in half. So there's now, where there was one courtroom that was two stories high, there are now two courtrooms that are all with lower ceilings in them, We've also now evicted, the county has evicted basically every other tenant in the building other than the law library and the district attorney's office, both of whom are fighting strongly not to be the next people to be evicted. We don't have enough courtrooms for the number of judges we have. We have two judges right now that basically move from courtroom to courtroom based upon somebody being on vacation or somebody being out sick so that we can use their courtroom and move around. We call them the shopping cart judges because, in essence, they pack up their personal belongings in a shopping cart and move them from courtroom to courtroom. And we're not the court house that's in the worst trouble in the state. I mean, realistically, it's Clackamas County. They are a county that's needed a new courthouse for several years, attempted to finance a new courthouse unsuccessfully, and as a result, as Mari can tell you about in a few minutes, they've ended up with not enough judges to litigate the cases that are necessary in their counties. In Multnomah County, we process about 200,000 cases a year come through that building. We have about 3,000 citizens in our county every single day who enter that building to conduct their work and to deal with their cases or to sit on jury duty or to testify. Those 200,000 cases, it's a real mix. We do civil work. We do all the criminal work in the county, anywhere from traffic citations up to capital murder cases. We do all of the family law work, although we have it. There's a court facility where we do the juvenile work that has six courtrooms out on 68th and Halsey. There are no secure hallways in our courthouse, as is the situation in many of the courthouses around the state. They were built at a time where that wasn't the way that you planned for court facilities. What that means is sharing the hallways are prisoners who are in chains, who are going to and from courtrooms, children who are there oftentimes with their parents, witnesses and victims who are coming in to testify. Somebody there dealing with a family law matter will be there in that same hallway. All of the courthouses in the Portland metropolitan area have suffered situations where someone has been killed in the courthouse or in a courtroom with a handgun within the last 20 years. Now, we are addressing that issue, and there's a lot better security than has been in those facilities in the past, but that security is very expensive to provide because the courthouse is not built in a manner to be able to safely move people in and out of the facilities. We have a lot of courtrooms that were originally built because of the taking 17 courtrooms, turning them into 40 courtrooms. We have a lot of courtrooms that are actually too small to conduct the business that we really need to conduct in them. They were built with six-person jury boxes, and with the consolidation of the courts now, they're hearing, those same judges may be hearing cases that, where there's a 12-person jury. So what that means is we have six people sitting in the box, and we have six plastic chairs lined up in front of the jury box. And in some of those courtrooms, as somebody walks up to the stand to testify, whether it be a witness or the defendant in the case, one or more of the jurors has to get up out of their chair to allow the person to get by to get into the jury box. That's just the reality of how we have to do business. Now, there are posts in the middle of some of these courtrooms. There are not jury rooms for each of these courtrooms. But the biggest difficulty we have in Multnomah County is just the structural deficiency in the building. It is one of the two most structurally unsound buildings in the city. There have been studies conducted dating back to the 1950s. There have been over 20 studies now conducted of the court facilities in Multnomah County, and they've all concluded the same thing. If there's any type of major earthquake activity, and we know that that will happen someday, whether it will happen tomorrow or happen 100 years from now, it will happen someday in the Portland metro area, just like it happened down in Klamath Falls. That building is in danger of structural collapse. Now, that's not likely to happen, but what is very likely to happen, and the studies indicate, is if the building is occupied, there will probably be fatalities in that building if there's an earthquake. We joke about it. I mean, we have to. We work in the building. We go there every day, and we talk about, is it better to be on the sixth floor and ride the slide down, or to be on one of the flea floors like I am on two, where your best options are run out the door as fast as you can get out the door. And that's the reality of working in that building. We have to address that. It is not going to get any better. That situation is just going to continue to deteriorate. We have situations, for instance, we had a sewage backup into our basement that Doug can talk about a little bit more with about a month and a half ago. That wasn't a direct result of the age of the building, but what it did do is just bring home to us again the fact that we have to store our computer equipment all down in the basement, and watching the employees down there working raw sewage trying to save that equipment just brought home to me again the need to address these issues. It's a real problem. Whether this is the way to address that problem or not, I don't know. But it's a way to, we've got to move forward on addressing these issues, not only in Multnomah County, but in the other counties in the state. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Further testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Bray. I'm the trial court administrator for the Circuit Court of the State of Oregon for Multnomah County. I just want to make two points in addition to what has been said, and this may repeat some of what has been said. First of all, the individual courts, and I think the Oregon Judicial Department, is not in an adversarial relationship with the counties about facilities. I think we understand each other very well. I think in every one of your jurisdictions, your presiding judges work very closely with your county commissioners on trying to address facility needs. We are very aware of the financial constraints under which the counties are operating at this time. And the counties have moved since 1981, when the legislation was adopted requiring them to provide facilities, from relief to be out from under the staffing costs and engine defense costs to viewing the requirement to provide court facilities as an unfunded mandate. We have to agree, we don't think they can continue to fund out of their own resources the traditional responsibilities they have had to provide courthouses within the community. The next point I want to make is that there are really two points of need in terms of court facilities. The first is physical integrity and safety in the buildings, and that is addressed somewhat in the map you have been provided, which shows the classifies the various courthouses around the state by age. And the other issue, though, is having court facilities that are actually sized appropriately to accommodate the needs of the community. Both of those issues are at a serious stage of need in many of the counties in the state. And some of them with newer facilities still have to face the problem that the needs of the county for public safety, for the enforcement of business economic contracts and transactions, and for individual needs in the court system can't be addressed in the facility in which they are currently located. It's simply grown too big. Some counties pass up additional judgeships because they can't accommodate judgeships. Others accommodate the way we have. We have judges that are essentially orphans, and as we rotate judges out to the juvenile court, we're able to accommodate them on a day-by-day basis. And the community courts and the community court function really is in a very difficult situation now with regard to facilities. And that this is really, I think, being brought to this body one more time as a problem for the Legislative Assembly to look at and try to help us find a solution. And I think the -1 amendments with the body of the bill do set us on a course that allows us to move in that direction. Representative McPherson's bill, separate bill, also is designed to try and move us in that direction. And if not this session, we'll be back another session with exactly the same problems. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Mari Miller, and I'm the trial court administrator in Clackamas County. I am here today primarily representing Judge Robert Seelander, who is the presiding judge in Clackamas County. He is on vacation, a well-deserved vacation, and expresses his regrets in not being able to testify before you today. Our courthouse was built in 1936, so we're one of the average courthouses. So as I describe this, you can translate that to the other courts in the state that are average. We were built with one circuit courtroom, and the rest of the courthouse at that time was housed many of the administrative functions of the county. Over the years, our county counterparts were evicted, just like they were in Multnomah County, and they built 8 new courtrooms in our courthouse. But Clackamas County has outgrown even those 9 to 10 courtrooms. We are one of the fastest growing counties in the state, and with that brings increased litigation, increased workload. And we have not been able, as Judge Koch indicated, we have not been able to request the 3 to 4 judges that we are understaffed for several biennium now. Not because we don't have courtrooms in the sense that we could share them like they do in Multnomah County, but we don't even have office space. So they would be probably working from their cars, pushing the carts up to the courtrooms. Our county has gone to the voters unsuccessfully 3 times and we've lost substantially at each one of those bond measure attempts. Now, the laundry list of work repairs that have been done in our building, I can't even go into them. It's so long. But just yesterday, I got a call that a section of our roof that had been repaired 3 to 4 times, 2 of them since I've been there in 2.5 years, around the edges of the repair, it collapsed again, and one of our judges had, with all the heavy rain, had washed out his chambers and destroyed some of his computer equipment and so on. I don't think that is suitable and sufficient, but on the other hand, the county can't even do the kind of repair work it's necessary to do on the roof without getting into having to do millions of dollars of upgrades in the way of earthquake and fire marshal type of upgrades, because once they start a substantial project like that, you might be talking about $3 to $4 million in other kinds of upgrades that they would have to do. But inadequate facilities are not just a matter of inconvenience like water in our chambers. When you have a courthouse that does not meet fire code, we don't meet fire code, and we don't meet earthquake safety standards. And daily we're exceeding the number of people in our courtrooms, in our jury assembly rooms, and in the hallways. And every time the fire marshal comes in, we promise we'll try to do better, but you can't keep people out of the courthouse. As Judge Koch indicated, criminal defendants are escorted through our main hallways just to get to the courtrooms. There's no security hallways, which is the standard for today for courthouses. And this represents a significant security risk for the sheriff's office and also for the public that do business in our court. Because of our lack of jury facilities, our jurors sit on chairs in the hallways and on the floor sometimes. And I'd say one day a week we have people sitting on the floor in our courthouse. We ordered a lot of plastic, stacking chairs to accommodate that, and the fire marshal made them take them out because they presented an obstacle for getting out of the courthouse in an emergency. Also, by having the jurors in the hallway, they are in contact with the litigants, with the attorneys, and with the defendants, which are all not good things and statutorily not correct. Judge Koch mentioned the daycare facilities. We don't have capacity to do that. A lot of people who do business in our court bring their children, and we have children sitting in hallways with criminals walking by them in chains and with armed guards escorting these defendants. Now, while Clackamas County may be the most overcrowded court in the state, it is just one of many courts, as you have heard, who's facing many severe courthouse problems. It is difficult to promote the concept of access to justice when our courthouses are overcrowded, when they're fire and earthquake hazard, and when they're in ill repair. Courts are a function of the state. They're created by the state constitution and the Oregon statutes. Circuit judges are elected state officials, and our employees are state employees. We are the third branch of Oregon state government, and yet all of our facilities are totally inadequate for the important role that we play for the citizens of Oregon. I think House Bill 2295 acknowledges the importance of the state's responsibility to work with counties to provide adequate court facilities. In our court alone, over 15 years of effort, and that's very devoted effort, have been brought to bear to try to fund a courthouse, and all of these efforts have been in vain. So we urge that you acknowledge your role as legislatures to help resolve the statewide problem and to move forward with this proposed legislation. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee, Representative Garrard?
Not so much a question, Mr. Chair, but the Chief Justice mentioned that Klamath has the newest courthouse, and in 1993, when our courthouse was brought down by an earthquake, I think the committee would be interested to know that we as county government were required to relocate all of the departments that had been in that courthouse. That was done at 16 different locations all around the community of Klamath Falls, which doubled and tripled the cost to the taxpayers in having to find all those new locations. And it stayed that way for 3 years until we were finally able to pass a bond measure to build a new courthouse. So there are a lot of ramifications should a natural disaster strike any of these buildings in any of these counties, and it is financially disastrous to not only the judicial system, but to the counties.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? I just have an overriding question because I've been here just long enough to have a little bit of institutional history, and I recall earlier task forces either in the 01 session or the 03 session. I think there was a collapse of one of them, and I can't remember what happened to the other. Can you give me some idea of what we've done before now in terms of the same type of task force? Or maybe I'm dreaming.
Chair Ackerman, there have been interim judiciary task force. There have been bills that have had task force in them where the bill has passed out of judiciary, but because of other parts of the bill or maybe the financial requirements, they have not proceeded out of ways and means. And that was part of trying to restructure this in a way that hopefully would take away some of those liabilities. But staff counsel Bill Taylor will probably be able to give you the most accurate record of what's happened. But to my knowledge, there has not been a formal task force other than the interim judiciary work group.
Fine. Thank you. That fills in my gap. Thank you very much. Further questions from the committee? If not, I'll excuse this panel and call up, I believe, our final two witnesses, Susan Graber and Paul Snyder.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Susan Graby, representing Oregon State Bar, and I'm here simply to say that we are in support of House Bill 2295 and the Dash 1 amendments. This bill is very important to us. We share the concerns expressed by the panel who testified previously. There are a number of concerns that the bar has in terms of ensuring access to the courts and ensuring that there is a safe and, as per statute, suitable and sufficient facilities available to the citizens of the state of Oregon. And I'm happy to answer any questions, but I believe you've heard probably enough, and I know Paul Snyder has a few comments from the county. Thank you.
Mr. Snyder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing this morning in opposition to House Bill 2295 with the Dash 1 amendments. I won't repeat the history that the Chief Justice has given you. I think it's very accurate and appropriate, but there's a little more history that I think reflects upon some of the reasons for the county's position. Going back in the mid-90s and beyond, the counties were in some... We went through some of the recession problems that the state has experienced along with you, but in many respects in ahead of you. And in 1999 and 2001, the Attorney General's Office did a report, two separate reports, with respect to the funding of district attorneys. The recommendations that came out of that report were that the state should contribute a larger share of the cost of funding the district attorneys. One of the attachments to the latest report, the one in 2001, I think explains part of the perception that our members have of the circumstances we find ourselves in. In the 2001 report, this report listed a number of revenue reductions that had occurred over the period of time before that. And it included changes in national forest receipts, annual ONC receipts, property tax changes from ballot measure 50, cost of other PERS changes, and House Bill 3349 PERS reforms. Those things collectively together created a biennial impact of about $373 million in revenue reductions to the counties. One of the biggest hits, as Representative Garrard will recall with some specificity, were to the ONC revenues and the national forest revenues. The good news with respect to that is that there was some relief provided by the Congress to the counties for those revenue sources. They created a safety net. The bad news is the safety net is scheduled to expire in 2006. If it's not reauthorized, there would be significant cost reduction or revenue reductions to the counties in those areas. You'll recall that we distributed copies of these charts to the members. Many of them actually have them up in your offices, and we appreciate that. But this is a chart that shows the relationship of various services provided by the counties and the state. Many of the state-funded programs are delivered by the counties, and so with the revenue reductions that the state experienced over the last several years, those revenue reductions translated into county-provided service reductions and commensurate layoffs of employees. The point of all this is to say that there is, I believe, an understandable perception among the counties that we are in an environment of limitation. And that environment of limitation, I think, drives a number of the concerns that the counties have. There is an organization called the Eastern Oregon Coalition, which is a group of the eastern counties that's been created to try to foster economic development in the rural areas of the state. The concerns that they have are equally appropriate for the southern coastal counties as well. Their perception is that they never really did enjoy the benefits of the revenue growth that the Valley experienced. And they're very careful and concerned about the availability of economic development funds, and they try and do the best they can with what they have to foster job growth and new businesses with the economic development revenues. One of the concerns that the Association of Oregon Counties has about the Dash 1 amendments is this specific addition of court facilities to the description of the appropriate use of the revenues from the lottery money. There is concern that there is not enough money to go around as it is for economic development, and to specifically add court facilities to that list becomes problematic for the efforts that they're trying to make already. We are, however, aware of the problems suffered by the court facilities that have been described to you today. It's important to recognize and to understand that those facilities are not just occupied by the courts, they're also occupied by the counties. Most county courthouses include the Board of Commissioners, the Juvenile Department, the District Attorney, the Sheriff, the Clerk, and a number of other county offices. And so the kinds of problems that the courts describe to you are also shared by the counties, day to day, every day. And we're trying to do what we can to relieve those problems with the resources that we have available to us. The Chief Justice's task force took an important direction, I think, from our perspective, and that was to recognize that it's important for us to come up with some solutions that are shared to the problem that we share, that the county revenue capacity to actually do something about court facilities is often very limited and has not, in some cases, resulted in positive outcomes because the voters in most of those cases just haven't approved general obligation bonds to construct new facilities. One appropriate thing that I think is also contained in the Dash 1 amendments, unfortunately other provisions are in there too, but is the availability of certificates of participation and general obligation bonding authority by the state to contribute to these kinds of facilities if it's appropriate under other circumstances. It's in some respects similar to the work that was done on Senate Bill 1145 with respect to community corrections funding, where in particular there were a number of facilities where the counties contributed its funds and the state contributed its funds. For example, there is a jail that's operated by Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, and Gillum counties that's funded by those four counties collectively along with the state. The state contributing certificate of participation funding and the counties doing the same thing. And something like that, I think, is an appropriate way to go. What we would like to do, notwithstanding our position on this bill, is to continue to work with the Judicial Department. We have supported the Court Securities Bill that just came out of the Criminal Law Subcommittee yesterday. We support House Bill 3124, which we'll work on this morning, with some modifications that would delete municipal and justice courts, which I think are in those amendments. And we recognize our joint responsibility to deal with this problem. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee to these witnesses?
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
It's
a question for Mr. Snyder. But one of the things that we heard from the earlier panel that was striking to me is that it would appear that our courthouses historically were multi-purpose facilities, and that what's happened as the need for more courtroom space has developed, they have increasingly become single-service facilities for the judicial function. And so I wonder if you have any views on the appropriateness of this policy choice made 25 years ago that facilities for courthouses would be a local responsibility and operating funds would then be a state responsibility. Or should we be reevaluating that policy choice?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think you're correct. In some counties, that's exactly the way things have evolved. Marion County, for example, is a county like that where now what was once the courthouse, well, it is still a courthouse, but it's primarily just the courthouse. And county offices have moved into another building where they share offices, I believe, with the city and with the transit district. In rural counties, that's less the case, but it is the direction I think many counties are going. I also agree that the premise with respect to the court takeover bill that the Chief Justice described should also be revisited. And I've talked with a number of people who were involved with that going back many years. And frankly, that occurred when we were just on the eve of another recession. It was just before we went into recession that that bill passed. And frankly, I think one of the concerns that I heard from people who would know was that to add the courthouse facilities to it would add too much to the price tag, and the bill probably wouldn't have passed. But it was not because there wasn't a concern for that. As a matter of fact, the report that was delivered along with the legislation expressed a concern and specifically stated, you know, this isn't the best of all worlds. This could become a problem. But under the circumstances, I think it said something like the best we can do. I'm sure the Chief Justice would know what the exact words were. But I agree. It is an issue that should be revisited. And one of the people that I talked with who staffed that group agreed with that and said, you don't go to a dentist just once. You don't change the oil in your car just once. It's been 25 years. Things have changed. A lot of things have changed.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a overriding question I'd probably like to direct to the first panel. You just sit there, and I just finished reading the... we're going to be on the dash one amendments. Is that correct, counsel?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And it strikes out pages 4 and 5, which specifically set forth a funding mechanism from the unitary assessment for the task force. The language which has been substituted in the dash ones takes lottery funds for, quote, services or financial assistance for the construction or renovation of state courthouse facilities. So my question is that broad enough to include paying for the costs and expenses of the task force? I don't know the answer to that, and if that's a huge question, it would be my intention to, in the interest of time, to move the bill and move the dash one amendment and take this issue up at the full committee, just in the interest of time. But I'm just raising that issue now because I don't know what the background was behind the dash one. Anybody have an answer?
For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. The language in those others could be broad enough. There would need to be specific legislation to, like, a ways and means to allow that revenue, because court financing or capital financing often includes the pre-planning stages, so there could be arguments made for that type of financing. Right now on page 1, the subsection 6, where it can accept other contributions, grants, and things, is the current mechanism with the dash ones, but it's not precluded with the other. We would probably need to add a specific bill that provided for that. My understanding is this bill, from its earlier version, did have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I believe that's still on it, so that could be discussion could happen there as well.
Yeah, I appreciate your answer, but I still think that I'd have counsel take a look at it to see whether, quote, services or financial assistance for construction or renovation of state courthouse facilities is sufficient language to cover the payment of the expenses of the task force, since they've been dropped out on page 5. And that's going to be our problem to work out. I'm just raising it. If anyone has any input, they could contact counsel, and if it has to be resolved, we'll do it at the full committee rather than hold it up at this level.
Thank you
for your supplementation of the legislative record. Are there further questions from the committee on House Bill 2295? Hearing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2295 and open a work session. And we need a motion on the dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wirth moves the -1 amendments into House Bill 2295. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing no objections, that's 11. The -1s are in. Motion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2295 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Wirth moves that House Bill 2295 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Hoffman?
Aye.
House Bill 2295 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Wirth will be the carrier, and I'll close the work session on that bill. Open a work session on House Bill 2749. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2749 defines certain nonprofit corporations as public bodies for purposes of the application of the Oregon Tort Claims Act. You have before you -2 amendments. If you recall correctly, this bill was originally heard April 11th when the other tort bills were heard. During that hearing, there was discussion about limiting the provisions of this act to define further define public bodies. The -2 amendments do that. Specifically, they defined the charities that qualify as public bodies as those that are organized under Chapter 65 of the ORS. They're recognized as exempt by the IRS. They file reports with the Attorney General, and they must expend 40% of the their expenditures on assistance to needy persons in the form of charitable activities and support services. The -2 amendments go on to make a list of those type of activities, not an exclusive list. Further, the -2 amendments exclude charities that provide health care services from the definition of public bodies for the purposes of the Oregon Tort Claims Act. They provide that when an officer, employee, or agent of a nonprofit corporation is sued, they may not request counsel from the Attorney General. The amendments also authorize a nonprofit organization to recover attorney's costs and fees if it successfully defends a claim based on whether the nonprofit corporation qualifies as a public body.
Counsel, you also sent a memo regarding the constitutionality of the bill.
Yes, there is there would be a likely constitutional problem with this bill to the extent that it would take away the remedy that was available at the time the Constitution was adopted. The Oregon Tort Claims Act limits, among other things, limits the liability that that public bodies have. So if these nonprofit corporations came under that act, it would limit the liability. To the extent that liability is limited, the remedy is limited, that an individual plaintiff can recover, there may be some constitutional issues with this bill.
Thank you, Counsel. We have the -2 amendments to work first, Counsel?
Yes.
Okay. I'll need a motion on the -2s.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2749.
Representative Flores moves the -2 amendments of House Bill 2749 into the main bill. Is there a discussion on that motion? Are there any objections to that motion? Hearing none, that's allowed. Need a motion on the bill? Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2749 to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 2749 as amended, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion from the committee? Chair Krieger?
Would you
ask Mr. Mannix whether he would like to address the issue of constitutionality. Give him an opportunity.
Didn't, because it was not before us until right now. But
okay. Well, I'd have him give him the opportunity if he'd like to.
I think that's fair at the full committee level. Want to do that at the full committee level, Chair, or do you want to
do it now? Let's do it now so we at least have it on record, please.
Okay, Mr. Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Kevin Mannix in Salem. The constitutional question arises out of a Supreme Court decision known as the Smothers decision, which talks about the constitutional right to access to the courts, to the right to trial by jury of certain issues. And the Oregon Supreme Court has said that whatever access to the courts you had at the time the Constitution was adopted, 1859, those rights need to be maintained. In light of that, we need to understand that the doctrine of charitable immunity existed in the common law and has been recognized in the common law even as of the time that the United States Constitution was adopted. The doctrine of charitable immunity was most recently reflected in English decisions in 1846, reflecting long-standing doctrine. We couldn't find a decision that was closer to 1859, but in 1846 there was a case under the Feoffees, I'll spell that, F-E-O-F-F-E-E-S, of Heriot's Hospital versus Ross. This is reported at 8 ENG REG 1508. If you want a copy, I can provide a photocopy. If you want to find one anywhere in the law libraries of the state, the only place you can find it is literally in the storage zone of the Oregon Supreme Court Law Library. But in this case, an English court again recognized that in Scotland and England, charitable institutions were immune as to the funds that they held. Individuals could be held responsible, as they always can be held responsible, but the funds were immune based on the doctrine of charitable immunity, the idea being that these funds were held in trust for the purposes for which the charities operated. I would also make available to the committee an outline that we've put together on charitable immunity in Oregon and the nation, which we put together yesterday, which outlines other states which have had longstanding recognition of the doctrine of charitable immunity to show that it's been recognized throughout the United States. Also, I would, for the record, let the committee know that the Oregon Supreme Court itself had no problem with adopting the doctrine of charitable immunity and keeping it in place for 51 years until 1963. When they set it aside, they did not set it aside for constitutional reasons. They set it aside because the legislature had never recognized it, and basically they said, enough's enough. If the legislature isn't going to put this into the statutes, then we're not going to do it anymore, and we get to make that decision because the legislature didn't make that decision. That's a simplistic recitation of what they had to say. The Supreme Court decision, which recognized the doctrine of charitable immunity, goes back to March 12, 1912, That was Hill versus President and Trustees of Tualatin Academy and Pacific University et al. That decision is reported at 61 Oregon 190 and 121 Pacific 901. The decision which, in effect, set aside the doctrine of charitable immunity came down in 1963, September 5, 1963. This was reported in Hungerford, H-U-N-G-E-R-F-O-R-D, versus Portland Sanitarium and Benevolent Association. It's reported at 384 Pacific 2nd 1009. I should give you the Oregon site, 235 Oregon 412. It's interesting to note that this is done as a matter of policy, not as a matter of constitutional interpretation. And the court said the fact that a rule has been followed for 50 years is not a convincing reason why it must be followed for another 50 years. They were saying this is a policy decision. They noted the legislature had never addressed the policy issue. I would like to note that the dissent pointed out that charitable organizations would over time be adversely affected. And we're back to the Supreme Court of Oregon, whenever it touched on charitable immunity, never having said that there was a problem with this doctrine being followed for constitutional reasons. They decided it on policy grounds. I appreciate the opportunity to put those remarks into the record. I'll provide the summary of charitable immunity that we've put together to the committee. I also will provide you with a photocopy of the hard-to-find 1846 English decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further discussion from the committee. I just want to raise a couple of points to explain what will be my no vote, aside from the constitutional issues which we've discussed, I don't think this body or the legislature can just merely bestow sovereign immunity upon private organizations, particularly when they have no attributes of any governmental entity, such as the power to tax or a representative board or fulfilling some governmental purpose. I also believe that sovereign immunity cannot be extended to these groups unless they are an actual instrumentality of the state and would get into a principal agency relationship. So for those reasons, I will vote against the bill. I also feel it's unresolved as to whether granting public agency status to these organizations, whether they now must comply with the public records law and the open meetings law, if they're going to be governmental agencies and take advantage of the caps provided by the Oregon, by the Tort Claims Act, then I think they have to act fully as a public agency and fulfill their public requirements regarding public records and open meetings. And I'm quite sure these private organizations don't want to give up, don't want to perform those governmental duties. So that explains my no vote when it comes to that time. Further discussion from the committee.
Mr. Chair, I might note, too, in if I'm reading the Dash 2 amendments correctly, it looks as though there's an, the potential for the public agency handling the cost of defense of the nonprofit. Maybe not a direct obligation. I'm looking at Section 4 in the Dash 2 amendments. It says that there may not be filed a request for counsel with the Attorney General. But the officer, employee, or agent may, however, file a written request for counsel with the governing body of the nonprofit organization, nonprofit corporation. Maybe I'm not reading this correctly. I'm just trying to absorb what's being said here. There was an issue raised in the original hearing, according to my notes, about who would bear the cost of defense of the nonprofit who was being handled under the Tort Claims Act. Maybe that's a question that somebody else is observing.
My recollection is, and Mr. Maddox can nod his head if I'm correct, was that these nonprofits would take advantage of the caps provided by the Tort Claims Act, but would have to bear their own defense costs.
Okay.
He's nodding his head, so we have rare agreement.
Okay, that answers that question. I share the concerns that you had already expressed, Mr. Chair, but that does resolve that issue.
Thank you. Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, then the clerk can call a roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Wirth.
No.
Chair Ackerman.
No.
Representative Trigger.
Aye.
House Bill 2749, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with the due pass recommendation, and Representative Flores will be the carrier, and the work session on House Bill 2749 is concluded. Open work session on House Bill 3124. Council.
Chair Krieger, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. The committee originally heard House Bill 3124, April 20th. You heard testimony regarding the Dash 1 amendments. This measure extends a sunset on the additional surcharge for court fees for 18 months. That is, that additional surcharge is 30% on specific fees. Further, the Dash 1 amendments exempt municipal, county, and justice courts from collecting these fees and distributing them to the judicial department operating account. It increases all their respondent fees up to 85% of the plaintiff's fees. It increases from $4 to $7 the amount of the clerk may charge for a writ of execution and garnishment, and increases the amount that the court may award for certain prevailing party fees, and also modifies provisions relating to justice courts of the Deschutes County. Again, those are the Dash 1 amendments of this bill. and those would need to be adopted to the original bill.
Fine. Thank you, Council. The Chair will move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3124. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1 amendments? Hearing none, the Dash 1 amendments are incorporated within the main bill, House Bill 3124. And the Chair will move that House Bill 3124 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair, I will give a courtesy vote to move it to the full committee for some further discussion.
Okay. Appreciate that. That's noted for the record. Further discussion on the bill? Hearing none, the clerk may call a roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 3124 as amended is forwarded to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. And the work session on House Bill 3124 is now concluded. And open a work session on House Bill 3336. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3336 deals with expert scientific evidence. Specifically, the bill provides that upon an offer of expert scientific evidence at trial, a court must first determine whether the theory or technique supporting offered evidence is based on scientifically valid principles and is pertinent. It specifies the factors that a court must use to determine whether the theory or technique is based on scientifically valid principles. It allows a court to seek the assistance of its own expert for the purpose of evaluating certain evidence. It provides that a witness may not testify about scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge if the compensation of the witness is contingent on the outcome of this proceeding. You have before you Dash 2 amendments. Those amendments clarify that the provisions apply to evidence offered at any stage of a proceeding, not just at trial. I also clarify that a judge must consider all the listed factors to determine if the evidence is based on scientifically valid principles. And finally, most significantly, those amendments exempt criminal proceedings from the provisions of this bill. I wanted to mention that exemption of this bill is not intended to change how the courts currently deal with expert scientific evidence in criminal proceedings.
So we have to move the Dash 2s, Council?
Yes.
Thank you. Is there a motion on the Dash 2s? Representative Gerard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 2s into House Bill 3336.
Thank you. Representative Gerard moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 3336. Is there a discussion on that motion? Hearing none. Is there any objection? No objections. That's allowed. On the bill as amended, I need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3336 to the full committee with a due-pass as amended recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Flores moves House Bill 3336 to the full committee with a due-pass as amended to the full committee with a due-pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the main motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
No.
Chair Ackerman?
Yeah. That shows 2-2, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Consistent with my agreement with Chair Krieger, I'll change my vote to aye in order to move the bill to the full committee. And with that notation, then the bill, House Bill 3336, is forwarded to the full committee with a due-pass recommendation, and I will close the work session on that bill. Open a work session on House Bill 3303. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, on April 6th, the subcommittee heard testimony regarding the Dash 1 amendments. Those amendments set out various requirements relating to contracts between state and counties. The state and counties, specifically, they provide that contracts between the agencies and the counties either must be contingent on future appropriations of funds or allow either party to terminate the contract if sufficient appropriation is not made. They provide that the state agency and county negotiate to renew or extend a contract, then the state agency may not propose new substantive provisions within 45 days prior to the expiration of the contract. Additionally, the Dash 1 amendments require that the inclusion of certain provisions in the contract between state agencies and counties and restrict or make void specific contractual provisions. You have before you Dash 4 amendments, which make a couple of changes to the Dash 1 amendments. They do include the Dash 1 amendments, and the changes they make are they exempt PERS contracts and contracts related to federally funded transportation projects from the bill. And second, they clarify that provisions of the bill apply to contracts between state and area agencies. Again, those are the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you, Council. Before I... we have a Dash 2 amendment on that bill, is that correct?
Yes.
I thought we were exempting out PERS.
That is in the Dash 4 amendments.
It's in the Dash 4. Thank
yes.
you. All right. Well, I'm confused on the Dash 2 is I had a Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3336 regarding the cap on library fees, and it was actually my intention to forward that Dash 2 amendment to the full committee, and I forgot to note that for the record, so I'll put that up. And actually, I'm speaking about House Bill 3336 now.
Do you mean 3124?
3124.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm reading my numbers wrong. All right, so we have to move the Dash 2s on this one?
The Dash 4s.
Dash 4s. Okay. The Chair will move the Dash 4 amendments to into the House Bill 3336. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, that's allowed. The Chair will move that House Bill 3336 as amended be forwarded to the...
I'm
running off on different numbers. Let's go back and I'll restate the motion. And I'll move that the House Bill 3303, as amended, be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? I just want to say briefly that we've worked with a number of people over the past couple of months to try to provide for the standardization of certain terms within agreements between the state and its agencies, particularly the counties, and we think we have a good work product here. Not all of the agencies are online with it. They've been in a torturous work session for the past 18 months with no result. I think we are achieving a good result with the standardizations provided in this House bill. Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 3303, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. And I will conclude the work session on House Bill 3303. Further business before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.
Yeah, you're right.